This podcast is sponsored by On1 Software, developers of the award-winning plug-in Suite 5. On1 Software, software that gets you back to shooting. For more information, visit their website at www.on1software.com.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to Lens Flare 35. This is Dave Warner, and today we're going to talk to director of photography, Darren DeLuco. By an unbelievable chance encounter, we ran into each other in the little town of Dallesville, just about 6 miles from where I typically record this podcast. And there was a group of people, they were just sitting around talking, and I kind of interjected myself into this conversation in this little bed and breakfast. It's called the Stony Creek Inn and Suites, and the key thing being the suites, right?
Correct.
And great natural pastries. And, you know, I found out Darren was a DOP. He was up from New Orleans. He had a 5D Mark II. We started talking about everything, and here we are face-to-face out at Spruce Lake. The lake's right out there. We can see it.
At Eats Pottery.
And Eats Pottery, man. It's right up here on the wall, you know? And it's like, I had no idea I live, what, 150 yards up the road that this thing was even here.
Right.
And that there were people who are interested in the same stuff I am, right out here in the middle of nowhere. So, Darren, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
So, anyway, now that we're here,
we're
filming, because you're a filmmaker
guy. This is the first official one of these that you're doing on the 5D, right?
This is the first. This is my 5D. This thing's probably going to have a hiccup, because it's never recorded video. So. So it's going to have a nervous breakdown doing this. This is cool. So anyway.
We're using all practical lighting here. We got our man Carl Wonson on the back there operating for us here today.
Carl's doing the thing back there.
Yeah. So a little Polaroid of me like that you can
find. We can do a Polaroid, man. This would be cool.
Get the talking mouth.
Yeah. So anyway, how'd you get into filmmaking?
How'd I get into filmmaking? There's a certain something that you kind of put together through the observations that you're making about the things that are going on around you. And I think people, some people, that turns into, they want to, you know, sometimes that turns into you being a lawyer. Like you're looking at it, you're looking at the way people kind of situate themselves in life, maybe fairly analytically around you, or you want to help them, or you want to, you know,
chase an ambulance.
Or you could be, I know the lawyer doctor thing is such the knee jerk reaction to that, but I was always putting together these, like, I was always putting together stories in my head. And I would always see the stories in a really visual, like in a really visual format. And they would entertain me. And you always try to, I would draw some of them out. But once I was able to get around a camera, a video camera for the first time, which I didn't really have any exposure to when I was in high school. But whenever I did, the two times that I did, I made two little small, kind of very, what's showing up on YouTube now, but POV kind of stuff where you're kind of addressing the camera. But I would put myself kind of in these different characters, like a real Italian guy, like a Spanish guy, and then like I guess one of them would be me. And I would make these little, I would make these little do-it-yourself, very DIY movies with myself. Mm-hmm. And then when I went to college, I went to Ithaca College in 1997. And I got thrown into, I was originally studying television and radio. I was an athlete when I was in high school, and I was really, that's when ESPN was on fire and it was really growing. And that SportsCenter shit was happening.
They're not on fire anymore?
No, they're totally on fire. I'm just not caught up in that world much anymore. Yeah. But at the time, that's all I wanted to do. I wanted to be an on-camera personality. And went to college at Ithaca College at the Park School of Communications that had this really amazing program and really great facilities, but the teachers there at the time that I was there were all these late 60s, early 70s experimental filmmakers. And they were, you know, they were thinking, they were giving assignments where you're like, okay, go make a movie. And you wouldn't have a camera to make a movie with. And you're sitting there, I'm sitting there like small, you know, came from a small town in upstate New York, fortunately had some friends and traveled around, so I had a little bit exposure to that world, and I was listening to kind of, I guess, firstly, I was listening to kind of more far-out music than I was looking at far-out films. But it was just the idea of just the fundamentals of photography and how you can kind of play with just the chemical process of it and just play with the film, because that was, like, the first assignment.
Yeah.
You make a film, with just the film, where you're scratching on it and maybe painting on it or taping materials that you find around, which that's all like Stan Brockage stuff and who else would be in there? Bruce Conner, but all those experimental films from the late 60s and early 70s, which is not a commercial filmmaker.
Charlie Schneem is another one.
Yeah.
Painting in there.
Yeah. It's not a normal commercial setting. Some film schools get you ready for Hollywood or get you ready for the production. You pick a position, you figure out how to be a gaffer, you figure out how to do sound, or you're doing, of course there's directing classes because everybody wants a director, and then there's director of photography classes.
Did you do any stills work in there, or why did you go straight to motion?
I took a bunch of still classes, and I was really attracted to the still stuff. But what I figured out through still photography is that I think the whole time I was figuring out compositions that I eventually wanted. I eventually put characters in, because most of the time if you're out there alone as a photographer and you're not shooting people and you're shooting spaces. I'm a huge fan of, and I know there's many others in this camp, of Terrence Malick. And his style of the DPs that he worked with were always just so use natural light and use environmental settings to their utmost. And I think growing up in the Adirondacks, there's something about the surroundings here where I think I really formed my aesthetic and appreciation for Malick and all those kinds of naturalistic kind of filmmakers and photographers through growing up in this like very super hyper natural world that we have here in the Adirondacks.
Super hyper natural. I like that. Okay.
but it's a place that I don't know. There's a lot of life in this, and that's why you found me at that coffee shop, because I was here. I was there with a local friend who's left and actually spent some time in New Orleans, and come back, but are constantly investigating their surroundings. So to lead that, I guess I'm kind of straying away from.
Yeah,
your
we're all over the map. Yeah. But that's okay. I'll guide you back.
Yeah, but the still stuff, like I said, fundamentally, you're investigating. I would always use that as a tool to investigate the world around me. And a lot of times I wasn't really into shooting people at that time. I wanted to just make compositions out of the world that was around me without people in them. And then, of course, I'm realizing that I'm just setting up compositions that I want to then eventually put, all you got to do is just put an actor in there, or your friend or your mother or your father in that composition, and you can have, and then it starts, and then when you turn it into motion, you have yourself the beginnings of a making of a movie. Because if you're based in really nice compositions, I think all you have to do is just put a little motion to it and add something in front of the camera, and they're so closely connected. Still photography and motion photography, yeah. I think.
So how do you end up in New Orleans then? You left the hyper kind of wonderful Adirondacks and you're in New Orleans. That's totally different.
After graduating from Ithaca College, I spent some time in the Dominican Republic, and I had spent some time earlier my senior year making, which we'll probably get into a little bit later, making what would come to be the first feature film that I was involved in. But I made it as a senior in college. We thought we were making a short film with this kid from Bolivia. So I had the first day that I had got my license, I was running away. I mean, I was driving the car like an hour further away from home than I was supposed to be driving the car. And always on the road.
And that is on film now. Can't get in trouble.
Right. I am exponentially closer to mom and dad as it gets here. But yeah, I always had that really excitable, super curious kind of energy to kind of like keep seeing new shit. And New Orleans, a friend of mine that I was going to school with, who's a jazz studies guy, who when I initially went to college, I kind of turned off pop radio and just started really immersing myself into the history of jazz music. And I mean, intensely so. There's a really cool segue story to this. There was my sophomore year of college, I'd get picked up by this guy, Joe DeVacy, and he was a really learned, studied jazz studies guy. Like, you could put on a track and he could tell you who was playing drums, bass, the saxophone, and the trumpet. Wow. And that just blew me away. So first day of school, 101 course with taking a drive to school with Joe DeVacy, I didn't know any of the musicians. You know what I mean? I was just totally in love with the music. Mm-hmm. The thing, the sound of it drew me in. Yeah. And then by my senior year, taking that same ride up the hill, like I was able to point out who was who in the, wow, you know, on the different tracks, yeah, which was cool. But that grew, a big relationship grew out of these musicians that I've always, still to this day, attract. I shoot a lot of musicians. I have a documentary that's sitting on a shelf that's about some really amazing musicians from New Orleans. But he was moving to New Orleans to go to graduate school for the opposite, like classical music composition. And I was there just as kind of like, it was a trip. And I wanted to go see this town, and I'd never been to the South before, never set foot in New Orleans. Like I said, I'd been in the DR and Bolivia a little bit before then, and was really interested in...
And I went to another country called New Orleans.
Yeah, exactly. It is another...
It's another country.
It's a place that's separate from all the things that can kind of... that can drive you crazy about... You're in the U.S., but you feel like you're in a whole other place. Yeah. It always gets kind of hippie talking about that place sometimes, but there's just a certain amount of freedoms that you have there that just socially are allowed, that you're able to do, and just the sensibility that attracts other like-minded people to that city. Because that story, my story of trying to go in there for 6 weeks on my way to the San Francisco Art Institute to hang out with George Kuchar, who's another amazing late 60s, early 70s filmmaker, and I stayed for nine years.
You never got there.
Yeah, I never got there. I made it to the West Coast, right, but I mean, it was for other reasons. But yeah, of course, I have just fallen in love with that place. Yeah.
Well, why'd you pick up a Canon 5D Mark II?
Good question.
happened.
Yeah. I've always kind of been attracted to the... I mean, we're guys who love to kind of like... You got to monitor that stuff, because you can geek out and you can lose like a day just geeking out on gear online.
Yeah.
But I'm one who has always been really drawn to the new tools that you can use, and the tools that you can use that are sometimes the cheapest that you can get your kind of like your vision across with, or the story that you want to tell. Or maybe the story you don't know that you want to tell, but then you find this thing and you can tell it. And the 5D just runs in line with that kind of thinking. When I was in school, it was when DV was coming out, so we were using the PD-150s a lot, and that was kind of, those were the workhorse, small, very small handheld cameras that you could, at that time, produce an image that was not compatible with film, but you could shoot on it and you could blow it up to film, mm-hmm, and you could still have some analog nuance with it. From that, it was the HVX 200, which was one of the first tapeless full 1920 1080 cameras I shot. So the first feature I shot with the PD-150 was the advent of mini DV. Second big feature that I had that did the rounds was this film, Lo and Behold, that was with the HVX 200, which was the first tapeless camera, which you were able to shoot HD handheld. And then the third film, the third was the HVX, fourth was with the Red camera. So I graduated to that guy. And then when the Mark II was coming out, Red still has this Scarlett camera that they're tempting with. And now there's a lot of other companies that have caught up. But at the time of the 5D Mark II, this is a real funny story. There's a guy by the name of John Hertzfeld, who is Sylvester Stallone's best friend, one of his best friends going through college. They were buddies in Florida. And Hertzfeld and Stallone seem to have this really wild relationship with each other. They can spend some time with each other, and then they don't spend any time with each other. And they can spend some time, and they don't spend any time. But Stallone was putting together this project called The Expendables. And they were looking for somebody to kind of like embed themselves in this film, because it could have potentially been one of his big swan songs. So you got all these big, you got Mickey Rourke, Jason Statham, Jet Li.
A lot of stars in there.
Arnold Schwarzenegger, Bruce yeah. Willis show up for a little yeah. while. Like, he got all the boys together,
yeah.
the old guys and the new school guys together, to make this big Rock'em Sock'em dude movie where they just blow up everything. And that's what, I mean, they were really, if you had a weird pair of pants on, they'd be like, get those pants over here, blow those goddamn things up. I mean, that's all they were doing around the clock. They just seemed like they were staying up late nights just to blow up shit.
Bunch of kids blowing
yeah,
up
exactly,
stuff. Yeah,
exactly. So they were looking for a guy to kind of do this portrait of Stallone, this kind of aging filmmaker who's a hero, an iconic figure in the history of cinema. I mean, Rocky and Rambo and all those movies. to hang out with him and make this movie about him while he was making this big movie. And at the time, it was right early on stages of the 5D. And Shane Hurlburt.
Mm-hmm. The guy we couldn't think of his name yesterday. Sorry, Shane.
Yeah. Sorry about that. I almost thought I was going to forget anybody. Yeah, it's clean. We got it.
We got it.
Yeah.
I said, Sean.
Yeah.
Shane.
Shane Hurlburt.
Yeah.
He met John Hertzfeld and really was just like, you should use this out of anything because it's the thing to get. So I show up the first day and they hand me one of these things, which I had heard about, and I just jumped right into it. When it was before the upgrade, it was before the firmware upgrade. So I had to point at my at a source like set and make sure, you know, like I would set my aperture via different rooms in the sets because it was constantly shifting back then. You couldn't really control it. You didn't have as much control as you have over it now. So there's like hundreds of hours of 3 5Ds rolling and an HVX 200. And this is pre knowing how to sync all that shit up. And we had 3 of them going, 3 of them shooting dock style with just a centimeter of focus, critical focus. So you're always, there's all this stuff. And Hertzfeld really thought we were making like a lit Hollywood movie for him. And it's just like, dude, you don't understand the tools that we have right now. You gave us this really awesome thing, but what it functions like a film camera. So we're opened up to 1.4. I can't close down to 5. You know what I mean? It's not a video camera. Everything's not going to be in focus. So, and he would sit down and look at the dailies, and he'd be like, oh, I hate that thing. Oh, you can't, you got to nail, when you nail the focus. He's like, dude, here, take the camera. We gave him the camera for a day, and he came back with, like, his head in his heels. Like, it seemed like he'd been kicking the camera around. Yeah. He's just like, I'm sorry, guys. But he was, and it was always chaotic like that. We would always miss something or not get this or that. So that was my first exposure with the 5D Mark II. And then I jumped into a bunch of RED projects. And then now I'm back after all the workflows have been kind of figured out with it. And I'm using the 5D... I'm using the 5D as a freelancer with the BBC. I'm using the 5D to shoot commercials. I'm using the 5D to shoot music videos. I'm using the 5D to shoot... I'll probably shoot a short, like a template for a feature, like a short film. Like the kind of process now is that if you can get some key people together in a small bit of money, like something under 10 grand or even 5 grand or even a grand, and...
Keep going.
Yeah.
You're in Spruce Lake, remember.
True.
$1,000 is like, you could buy half the lake.
Building costs about $1,000.
Where we're at is $1,000.
Exactly. But you kind of get your vibe or your feel or your tone, or if you're going to introduce something, some kind of new storytelling device or format into the world of filmmaking, you make it in a 5 to 10 minute length film, and you really enforce and kind of show off your thinking at the time. And then you take that 10 minute piece that you've gotten a great DP, a great director, a great writer, and some great actors. Usually it all hinges on the performers. Like all you need is a guy with a camera and one really amazing charismatic person in front of a camera, and you can make a goddamn movie. But if you can do that, it's happened 3 different projects I've worked on. I've shot the little short film for a micro budget that then has gotten a proper budget to shoot the feature with. That one just went to the Cannes Film Festival and the other one went to Sundance. But it's a really nice, and with these cameras, with the 5Ds, you can do it in such a discreet way. Because a lot of first time filmmakers are trying to tell a story that's usually close to home, because you have to have some sort of like real nice authorship to your story, so people can tell that you could create some sort of legacy for yourself, or you have some more time to spend around. Because if you can tell a story that's super close to you, typically a dramatic story, I always think of my buddy David Gordon Green on this one, because his track record right now is so awesome, because he started out making these really super personal, low budget independent films, and now he's making, you know, $80 million comedies with Danny McBride, and they're having a blast. But those first ones that you do, you're trying to tell these intimate stories, and you don't have the tools, but you know how you want to tell it. And if you can't you couldn't really tell that story with all the money, because sometimes the money can kind of destroy a really fundamentally great, simple idea. And then you throw a bunch of money and a bunch of lights and a bunch of assholes around, and they take the movie that you're trying to make that's so personal you away from you. Mm-hmm. So if you can do, if you can take, if you can get, you can rent from, I don't know if you know, yeah, I can drop this, they might like it, the lensrentals.com.
Or Lens Pro to Go.
Or Lens Pro to Go, yeah. That? You can rent a 5D, four lenses, a Red Rock stabilizer for a week for under a grand, mm-hmm. which is a...
There's the budget.
There's your budget. Get your $1,000 together. Tell your, call up your best buddy from Arkansas. Tell him to get some gas in the car. Drive down. You know what I mean?
Arkansas?
Well,
we're in the outer Rondacks. Right. Arkansas.
We can just call up somebody down the block in Little Falls and have them come. I mean, there's... Speaking locally, there's so many... I'm in the process of right now developing developing a film that I hope will be shooting up here late summer, early fall. But this is just a place, clearly because I grew up here and it's super personal to me, but it's the place where I want to make my first like directorial debut, because I've been kind of crossing over a bit recently with DPing and directing. Which, it's funny, when I kind of stepped out, I didn't realize that there were going to be so many other... I was going to have a big company, because there's a lot of DP directors that are of my age, maybe a little bit, some a bit older, that are all kind of coming out right now. And there's like agencies that will rep you as a DP director, which is cool. Oh, so there's a infrastructure for it. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that was, I think I started off with, why did you get your first 5D?
Where are we?
Right.
All right. So
yeah.
How do you think the industry as a whole has been affected by these kinds of cameras? Not maybe necessarily the 5D Mark II itself, but the fact that we have all these different cameras shooting this 1080p stuff, 24, 25p, 60, 70p, slow motion.
Yeah.
How have they really affected the industry?
That's a good question. It's tough. It's given the ability for more people, just the numbers is kind of funny, because it's given the, you put this type of equipment, high-end equipment, for way lower cost, for $2,500, $3,000 you can have one of these cameras, or even lower for the T2i, you can get one for under $1,000.
So and you recommend shoots, somebody, I mean, that's...
For the web, it shoots great. I mean, yeah, I would use it for the web. If you're going to blow it to 35, blow
it up to... You wouldn't put it on a 40-foot screen, then?
A T2i, if it serves the, if that look works for your movie... Yeah, shoot it on an iPhone. You know what I mean? That's, yeah. Go for it.
Yeah, I've seen your iPhone footage. So.
But it's not, you know, at all. I don't. Yeah, it's, I think the I see a lot more presence of Red. There's been this like really scary conversations that people have that just seem doomsday sometimes about this film versus the digital thing. I think people are going to keep shooting on film for a while, because I just see it. I see it still in the commercial world, still in the TV world, and still in the movie world. And film's just, like, undeniably amazing.
Well, is it an encroachment, then, kind of thing that's happening, where these cameras are taking a larger and larger percentage as the years go on, as they get better? I mean...
It lets new filmmakers and existing filmmakers tell the stories in a much more, like, you can hold these things. You can hold this camera. Mm-hmm. A kid can hold this camera. It's not a heavy thing. It's not a bulky thing. It's not invasive. It's not, you know what I mean? It's a very usable kind of tool.
Well, like that season ending.
House. Right. For a house. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I mean, the winner, awesome. The winner of one of the biggest American film festivals, the South by Southwest Film Festival, which is becoming huge. The film that won Best Feature Narrative was a film that was shot on the 7D. And this was last year's festival, not this past year's, the year
before.
So it was when that technology was super early and they used it to tell a story that wasn't it looked like, it's a movie. Yeah. It's a great story, but they were able to do it because it, makes it for a much smaller budget. If you get the right kind of shooter, you can kind of cheat the fact that you don't have a bunch of lights, but it looks like you got some lights.
We got some light.
I don't think that Hollywood is threatened. I think they've kind of embraced the 5Ds, and they'll always embrace ways to tell stories, because they know that they have lockdown on the big movie toys. If you want to tell big movie stories, you're not going to be telling a big movie story, a big like Avatar, with a 5D. You have to then go get the proper stuff.
Yeah.
But I say the more I just shot something on Super 8 a week ago, so I'm still shooting on film, but I'll jump into the 5D, and so I'm still using, everybody said those lens adapters would die away, but I'm still using a Lettuce on an EX3. It's a Lettuce relay lens with mm-hmm. the Lettuce Ultimate or whatever, and Zeiss lenses. Because there's still something, there's like a little analog-y-ness that creates. Because the 5D for a while, if you're using the Canon lenses, it can have like a stock look. It can have a look. Mm. It can be like a Kodachrome or this or that. You know what I mean? It can look like it was shot on a Bolex or, you know what I mean? How mm-hmm. film shots can create just a look and a yeah. camera that you can shoot on. Like some people say that they can tell when a movie or a commercial was shot in the red because the footage just has this look. But
I would buy that.
It with the 5D, I found that if you put some nice glass on it, that's going to change. But something about good or not great glass on those lens adapters with that shooting the reflection, and you get that kind of, there's some analog thing that comes through there that just creates a nuance that doesn't feel so damn crisp. But you can always break that down in post if you want to. I try to shoot as much of things that I can in, you know, I like to try to get stuff in camera, as close as I can. With coloring, clearly it's a little bit different.
No, that's good.
There's no. I don't see Hollywood feeling threatened by Canon right now because all these companies are like, have just raced to their factories and have made and designers and have come up with some really cool. There's some competition now. Sony's got a badass camera coming out. Mm-hmm. Panasonic has a camera coming out where you can go straight into the sensor with the lenses, so you don't need the adapter. But whenever you can use a proper 35mm camera with proper lenses, it's always great. But you should be able to tell story. You should be able to tell stories with, you know, with whatever you want. Like we said, an iPhone or even cheaper, those flip cameras. Those flip cameras are pretty cool. Wild.
Yeah, they are.
And you can, if not, it's always good. I think it's, you can use them as sketchbooks. Even, you know what I mean? Because you can kind of like
storyboard reference. With them.
Yeah, exactly. Storyboard with them, or do look. Yeah, storyboard's the best way to put it.
Well, okay. So has there been like one single thing that, it's been about 2 years, a little over 2 years since the 5D Mark II came out.
Yeah.
Okay, has there been any single thing that just really surprised the hell out of you? That, oh my God, I never thought X with this camera.
Yeah, the first 5D thing that blew me away that I saw, I don't know the filmmaker's name, but I just know the beginning image.
Sean something, wasn't it? No.
The beginning, it's a video clip that made it through all the main blogs, but it's that, it's on a slider, and it's in like Egypt or something, and it's going from left to right, and there's a kid in the dunes, and there's a camel in the scene, and the camera's just floating from left to right. And then it punches in into the streets of Egypt. I'd gotten back from there like months after I saw this. And months after I shot something on a totally different camera that I wish that I had a 5D to shoot this shoot with. But, that was the first time that I saw it. And it was, I could not believe what it was doing for a still camera. Cause they had that. And then next to the image of that video underneath it, they posted pictures of the shoot. And it's just this young guy with this super, like, at the time, just like cheap looking slider.
Kind of like what I'm trying to build down in my garage.
Yeah, which I still want to see.
I didn't get to put it together yesterday. I was talking with you guys.
and then this little, you know, this little DSLR. And I was pretty skeptic right off the bat. But once you saw more of the footage and you actually had a chance to shoot, see it get ingested into the computer, see it get turned into ProRes, and then see it go through the whole post-production process. I've been at tests with, like, in New Orleans at the new CineWorks lab there, where they've done the full shot on 5D, put comparison into DaVinci, color corrected, and then blown up to 35. They have like little, you can go see 30-second rips from a 5D Mark II, from a 7D, and everything, just like they did at the Zacuto. But it's great when you see it in the theater and you see it in person. It's amazing how much the crazy. The sensor is massive, holds up.
Well, okay, so if a stills guy wanted to take a path, wanted to go down and say, look, I'd like to do some of this video stuff.
Mm-hmm.
What would you tell him to do?
Definitely do it. And like I said before, I think we're fundamentally all kind of going out there and the framing and the and what we're doing with compositions, all you got to do is just put in a unless you want to tell a movie without any actors, keep just shoot whenever you take a still, shoot some video, like right behind that or before that of whatever you're shooting. That's a still, because you can create such a nice story of an arc. It's going to sound really far out there, experimental, but or maybe not to some, but you could create a whole story with just those images, with the images without any actors. Mm-hmm. And you could create some really great environmental,
some great music.
Yeah, exactly. And I would certainly suggest it with these geese out here.
Oh, the geese are.
I would do pick an environment, and you do like a real passive portrait of a space. It doesn't have to be a person. Or if you want to get some people involved, that's when you have to put on like your charismatic hat, because you gotta like go up to somebody, unless it's your buddy, and ask them to perform for you and direct them and interact with somebody. But I would say every single time you shoot, every outing you take to go on a still shoot, you should just think of it as a double thing.
Do both.
Yeah, because a still image is like the foundation, like I've been saying, I'm sorry if I'm redundant, but is the foundation to really awesome moving images. So I would just snap off some video, like 10 seconds, yeah, or 5 seconds even, a video of each still that you do. But I know a bunch of photographers that are starting to shoot video, and the results are really cool, because they're pointing the camera at things that, because you can still kind of get away with it. If you're doing like little, if you went around Dallasville and told everybody that, it's kind of a sneaky move, but if you told people that you're taking stills of them, but you're really taking video, and you just were kind of talking to them while you're setting up, but you had the camera there and they were there, they would never know. And even if you tell somebody, I know it's a still camera, but I'm shooting video, do you mind if I interview you? And they say yes, you're going to find there to be a way different experience with what will go down with that person if you were to bring like a big ENG camera in. They would freeze. There's no red light that's blinking at them. The camera's small. It's so discreet. Dock settings for these cameras, I still haven't seen it yet. I know there's probably like 10 of them that are going to come out this year that are going to be the most amazing docs that you've ever seen, and they're all going to be shot on these things, because you can just get into people's worlds a lot easier, because it's not invasive. It's such a tiny little discreet camera. You can forget it's in the room. Ease.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, we forgot.
And you can, I mean, if you wear dark and you talk to the person, the camera's here. No, I'm saying, like,
what are you saying?
While you're shooting, if you just have some kind of like dark clothes on, the camera will just fall into your clothes. If you're standing and talking to somebody, they'll forget that the camera's there. And you'll get them to kind of like the stuff that will come out of them will be more rewarding to you as a filmmaker than if you were to show up with a shooter and a sound guy,
the boom.
You gotta have the sound guy, but
yeah,
okay, we're done.
Well, what's your next project then? What are you off to next?
Immediately next, there's always a bunch. I always have a bunch of things going on.
Well, you got that one on the shelf, right? You need to dust off, right?
Correct. The one that I want to do up here, is that the one that you're alluding to?
No, or? I'm just saying, what are you off to next?
Oh, the one on the shelf. Yeah, you said you had one on the shelf.
One on the shelf. I'm thinking, why is it on the shelf?
I've got like 100. I have 100+ hours of footage that I've documented of these two friends of mine in New Orleans who go by Quintron and Miss Pussycat, which are, he's an inventor and musician, and she's an inventor and musician, and she's a puppeteer, and they're just a really wild little couple. But what I jump into next is finishing off that ad campaign for Defend New Orleans. I've been doing some freelancing for the BBC, and they like this kind of more like cinematic storytelling, so I've been doing some of that. I'm recording an album as well. I've been putting together some music, and I want to get an album out at the beginning of the year. It's one of these.
So this is your deal?
Yeah. I've got this checklist of things that I want to do.
Okay, bucket list.
Yeah,
for a young guy.
I don't know if I want to commit to calling it the bucket list, but it is definitely a list that I wanted that I've. I just auditioned in front of freaking Tim Robbins and God damn it, Mr. Simon from who did The Wire,
really?
And The Tremé. I just auditioned in front of those two guys, which was cool for a part in The Tremé. I don't think I got it, but it was really rad to get the audition and do it. And I mean, what brings us full circle back to kind of like our immediate location is this story. That I want to do that takes place here in the Adirondacks. I went to, I haven't really talked about it much at all. Certainly not publicly.
So breaking news, man.
No, yeah.
No, right? You know, like everybody wants we do to know breaking news, you know? But I'm wearing the banner.
I went to this event last summer with my friend who's also in this room operating the camera, Carl Wonson, called the Unadilla.
Carl, man, you can come out and step in front of the camera. You got that spicy hat on, you know?
Yeah, so this will really push it up.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to
do it on loggers.
Yeah.
You know?
We went to this motocross event, and it kind of certainly inspired the. I've been wanting to tell a story about this place for a long time, and it's hard when I don't know. This is a weird thing to say. I guess I kind of want to say it this way. It's hard when you're a creative person because you can have a bunch of ideas. And you can kind of fall in love with them for a little while, and they'll take them. They kind of run their course, or some sit with you for a long time, or you can't quite figure it out what it is you want to do because it's. I know I love this place. I know I love the Adirondacks. I know I love this town, and I always talk about where I come from, and I always say that I want to be making a movie here for a little while. It was like a seasonal documentary about people during spring, fall, summer, and winter. Another iteration took place with like this snowmobile thing. Another iteration.
Snowmobiling is big up here.
Yeah. Another thing was another thing. And then it was focusing on more. I was into the summer. I'm always into like, certainly like teenage sensibility. I just think I there's nothing that I really want to say, nor do I hang out with like average. This is an awful thing to say, but like,
you're saying you're not,
there's nothing crazy interesting about like successful 40-year-old Caucasian men. So I don't really, really want to make stories about them. Yeah. I think they're wildly interesting, but I'm just super interested in the kids that are kind of maybe down the street and getting fucked up or, up in the woods, you know, being imaginative, because I think there's a lot of ground to maneuver when you're a teenager. And if recently, I don't know, it's come up a bunch in this turning 30 and kind of thinking about that time period, and particularly riding around the street. Yeah. The summer, I just kind of rode around the hills in the Adirondacks.
Does Unadilla resonate with you at all? Do you know what that is?
No.
It's a motorcycle race. It's a motocross race that takes place less than an hour from here.
Yeah.
And it's got a grand tradition in that world. I mean, it's people have been doing it there since, you know, the late 60s or the early 70s, as long as there's ever been sort of professional off-road racing like that. And
it's an infamous track that's carved out of a farmer's land.
Wow. It's beautiful. It's an incredible scenario.
I'm still back on the fact that he looked at me and said, white guys in their 40s.
Right.
I'm still glowing about that.
Right.
So.
Right. we were checking it out, and we were both looking at it sort of photographically, but looking at it as people, like, we don't know much about this world. I think it's fascinating. I think, you know, racing is interesting. Any kind of, like, racing kind of fascinates me. But we're looking at, like, the beauty of the track, and then these wild sort of day glow, you know, nights. It's like this kind of, it's like a man on a horse, you know, but it's not a horse. It's this screaming, tiny, you know, engine that's like in the air as much as it's on the ground. Wow. I mean, they literally, like, they're called, the racers are actually called factory pilots. And you're like, you know, how can you be a pilot of something that rolls on the ground? But it's like, they hit these jumps, and I mean, you can't believe a machine, like anyone would hurdle themselves
right
through space on a machine like that with a hope of landing.
And all this, it's amazing. I love, all this stuff comes from, like, I think any event we would go to, even motocross or not motocross, it's always the thing of when you go into an event, or you're going over to a new person's house, or you're going to the mall, or you're going to some place maybe seemingly quite normal. But you enter that space in agreement that you're kind of watching it with.
Okay, it's a motorcycle race, but
no, it's a movie. It's right, you're making right. a movie while you're in.
Right.
But not a motorcycle race. Right. It's your sister's, like, there's a christening or something, but it's always, you're always seeing it through the eyes and using, like, responding to language as if it's, like, kind of like it's your own little movie.
Right.
You know what I mean? Yesterday when we were sitting around talking around, there was part of me that was looking at it one way, another way that was looking at it another way, another way that was looking, but always kind of
wasn't in the film, though.
How can, you know, and, like, it might sound ridiculous or a little contrived, but, like, how can you borrow from the present? What's going on in the moment?
Right.
How can you translate that? All those amazing things that happen in the moment.
And what else can it be in a sense? What can you turn it into? Like we're looking at it and we're thinking a lot of different things, but we're thinking like it's kind of like a Western, you know, where you have guys chasing each other on horses. It's also kind of like Kurosawa was a big touchstone because these guys are sort of in armor and they have these like totemic insignia splashed all over the place that it has a feudal kind of feel. And they look really aggressive and their machines are aggressive. You know, they look like warriors, you know, of some sort.
I would say there definitely would be if it's in a year's time, they're probably going to be coming out with something new, but I would say there's probably going to be at least one of these guys around the set. I'd love to shoot it on Super 16. Or even 35 or the... most likely it'll be shot... Is it still going?
Yeah.
Most likely it'll be shot on the... I would think on the red. Just because it's just like... For me, as a first time filmmaker, I'm going to want to see this stuff.
Yeah.
And it's very hard to do... It's not very hard to do playback because they're always recording a digital feed when you're shooting 35. But with the red, you can have a DIT on set and you can have everything kind of sorted right there. Knowing... You can even do like a quick rough edit of a scene.
So that's a limitation to these systems.
What's that?
The fact that you can't see it immediate like that. Have it all the different.
No, that's
pieces.
A great. It's not a limitation. That's an advantage for these cameras.
All right,
because you can see it quick.
Okay.
I was saying with 35.
Okay. All right.
With these, you can do a rough edit like after you did your final like coverage take. Like if you're shooting a scene in a room, you can shoot your wide, your close-ups, and then like while you're making your transition to the next set before you totally break down, make sure you. It's always hard to gauge it when you're right there in the middle of everything, but you can at least see a rough. So with these things, you can with the 5Ds, and because you're always burning cards in.
Yeah.
It always scares you when we're kind of going off on anything, but it always scares you when you erase the card the first time after you've backed it up. Jesus, what am I doing?
Believe it on stills. It's the same thing, you know. I back it up again, yeah. And then
all
I go,
hard drives.
Oh, format. Oh.
Yeah. It's terrifying.
Did I get it?
It's terrifying.
Well, Darren, I really appreciate you being on the show today and giving me your thoughts about HD DSLRs and Carl for joining us. Appreciate it as well.
Absolutely.
Awesome, man. Thank you so much.
All right. I want to point out to people listening today that we post this interview on www.currentphotographer.com and on iTunes. My guest today has been director of photography, Darren DeLuco. I want to thank him for being on the show, and I also want to thank all of you for listening to Lens Flare 35. We'll see you next time.
Thanks, everyone, for listening today. Remember, for more on-demand podcast articles and information, please visit our website at www.lensflare35.com or subscribe to Lens Flare 35 on iTunes. We'd also love to hear from you, your comments, feedback, and questions. Send us an email at editor@lensflare35.com, make a comment on the site, or write a review on iTunes.